the views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
We have made our start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise.
Good evening, listeners. Wow, what is that noise? I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in tonight. And we have another excellent show for you Tuesday night. Dr. Ben Arroyo is back with us, but more about him in just a minute. A couple of very quick announcements for you. And let's see. The first one is the Space Show and myself personally offer a great congratulations to Elon Musk and his girlfriend for the birth of their son. And other than saying congratulations, and we wish all of you the best and a great life for your son and a great future, we support you. And the pictures I saw on Twitter of your of you holding the baby were great. You look a little tired and worn out. But congratulations, Elon, and to your wife and to your son. And we wish you a great life together and all the best. The second is there's no show on Sunday, which is Mother's Day. So we typically don't do programs on Mother's Day and Father's Day. So we're off on Sunday, Mother's Day, but we do have Hotel Mars tomorrow with Eric Berger. And then we do have our Friday Space Show program, as usual, 9:30 in the morning. And our Friday program has George Sowers on. Now, all of you know him. He used to be at ULA. He's now a professor at the Colorado School of Mines. And George is becoming a frequent guest, and we appreciate the fact that he's here and look forward to his return on Friday morning. As for tonight, we're doing a full-length 90-minute Space Show program, maybe a little longer. We'll see how the phone traffic is. So still watch your clocks. If you want to talk to Dr. Ben Arroyo or if you want to email him, make sure you do it while we're still on the air. And that's always really helpful. And our guest, of course, is Dr. Chaim Ben Arroyo. First, our phone number for tonight, 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners, let the phone ring, and we'll answer it and get you up on air as quickly as possible. We do take calls during the break, and we hold you until we come back on the other side of the break. You can email us at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. You can also post comments to us on the blog, which is our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right for upcoming show menu. This is the first program listed, so you open that page, scroll all the way down to the bottom for comments, and post away. And as soon as you hit send, I will be able to integrate what it is you want during the program with our guest tonight. Our website newsletter is up and running, and you can also access it on our homepage, upper right. Make sure you scroll down. You'll see all of the programs that are listed and coming up in the future. We're now totally booked through May. And we're probably maybe half booked through June, and I need to add in July through the end of September, and I'll probably start doing that in the next couple of days. If you have a guest you'd like to suggest for us, please do so. I'm running a little behind and following through on them, but give me email address if possible and any references to any of their work so I'll know why you are recommending that person, and we'll see if we can get them on the Space Show. And we look forward to your guest suggestions. A big portion of Space Show guests come from you, the listeners, suggesting various guests for us. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website, very rapidly download the program. We do have a store if you're interested in Space Show logo wear. To get there, click on any of the website pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and she will walk you right into our Cafe Press store. Upper left has an interesting menu. It does under support. It has a Support the Space Show button. But before we get there, it also has Listen to the Space Show. You'll see a Listen button. So this tells you how to listen to live programs, as we're doing right now, the podcast version of the program, and also the compressed MP3s on our website. If you have any podcasting questions regarding your platform of choice or your podcasting client of choice, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then, as I said a minute ago, there's also Supporting the Space Show up there. But we are a 501c3 nonprofit. We're listener-supported. I say this every week. You, the listeners, keep us going. And double thanks out there to those of you who are continuing to support us and work with us during these very challenging times because of the COVID virus. We really appreciate that. We're keeping the program going full blast with all of our programs per week, usually four shows per week. And we're staying current on all of our bills despite economic stresses that probably many of you also have. So we are very, very appreciative when you support us, because we know most of us are all experiencing some real challenges right now. But the Space Show is moving forward, and we thank you for listening and participating and for your guest suggestions. Which brings me to one other thing. PayPal is the best way to support us. You'll see our PayPal link on the top of each of our website pages. But for those of you who don't want to use PayPal, you can use an old-fashioned check and put it in snail mail. Make it payable to One ONE Giant Leap Foundation, and mail it to Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920. And then don't forget we have sponsorships, and they get the sponsor's banner ad going across our homepage, which you can change as often as you like. And then on the full-length programs, like tonight, I'm going to read a sponsor message when we break between the first and second segments. And on shorter versions, I shout out a deep and meaningful thank you to each one of our sponsors. But to save time, I don't read their messages. So if you want to be a sponsor, we still have a few sponsorships available for the year. Email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. So once again, Dr. Ben Arroyo, Chaim Ben Arroyo, is our guest tonight. And he's a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Rutgers University. He's a very well-known lecturer, both at national and international space conferences. He's also a true blue space advocate, for sure. He has his PhD and his master's in engineering from the University of Pennsylvania. His space interests include the modeling of space and lunar base structures, space business and technology transfer, as well as economic and political factors that affect space commerce. He has published many related articles, peer-reviewed publications, and some really great lunar books that we will talk about in a little while on the Space Show. We do whenever Chaim is on the show. And if you haven't gotten hold of him, then you really should. But again, we'll talk about him probably as we start the second segment of the program. Chaim, welcome back to the show. How are you tonight?
Great, David. It's great to be back.
How are you doing in New Jersey? Are you? My voice has been bad the last couple of shows. I don't know why. How are you enjoying being shuttered into your residence?
I guess I'm okay. Teaching at Rutgers, like most universities, is online, so that's been a challenge. I've tried to make it work for my students, but there are a little bit of hiccups here and there, but now that the semester is ending, I feel that I have a pretty good handle on it.
Are you going to go back to the classroom in the fall, or do they know yet, or what?
They don't know yet. My understanding is that they'll decide sometime during the summer once they see how it evolves here. As you know, we're at the epicenter, not far from New York here, so we're still challenged But, you know, I do go for walks outside because where I live is not very populated. It's a, New Brunswick is a college town in many ways, so a lot of the students aren't here. So the streets are pretty empty, although I do see people getting more and more brave and venturing out for a little bit of sun.
Are you sneaking out with your wife to the beaches?
No, that might get me arrested, but I but I do walk around the campus, which is not far from where I live.
Can you actually walk to campus from where you are?
I can walk to one of the campuses, not the one I teach from, but the one I teach from is about 2 miles away, so I guess I could walk there, but usually I stick to the nearest campus.
Well, when I was there with you, I thought that one was pretty far. That's why I asked.
Yeah. It's a big campus area, but and it's quite beautiful. A lot of parks, a lot of trees, so it's fortunate to be amongst the campuses, really.
Well, let's walk over to where we're going to blast off for and go to the moon for a while, okay?
Okay.
So it seems to me that the most activity for going to the moon, returning to the moon, is kind of taking place in the White House. So that's kind of strange, but we have an executive order about lunar resources and in situ mining and space resource utilization. We now have a Trump administration draft for mining on the moon that I think was released either today or, yeah, I think it was released today. So it looks like the action is coming out of Washington, but I don't know if there's any action with the companies. I don't know. I know I talked to Mastin yesterday, and they're hard working ahead on their lunar lander. How do you see what's happening with our lunar return efforts, and do you think we're going to make any reasonable timeline, or how do you see it?
I think there's a lot of challenges still. I think that we certainly have an ally in the White House as far as getting back to the moon. For whatever reasons, you know, the Trump administration and the president are very eager to get back to the moon, and they pushed back the original timeline from 2028 back to 2024, which is really challenging considering we're at 2020, right?
Right.
So I don't know. If I had to bet 2024, I'm not sure that I would, at least not at the current funding levels. But even if you multiply the current funding levels, say, by two, right, instead of, what, $20 billion, make it $40 billion a year, I think that you can only go so fast because you have to develop the technology, you have to test it. Manned space is an order of magnitude more complicated than unmanned space. I think we're heading there. But then, you know, you and I have been seeing this for 30 years, right? And we've been saying it every quarter, 8 years. We've been saying, you know, we're heading there until administrations change and goals change.
How do you assess the likelihood of doubling the allocation funding for going to the moon, given what's going on with funding everything else in the country right now?
Yeah, I don't see it happening. But, you know, quite frankly, you know, when the federal government prints, you know, $2 to $3 trillion and sends it out, adding another $20 billion doesn't seem like a big deal, does it?
No, not in compared to the virus bailout bills, which were talking what, several trillion dollars.
Right,
so,
several trillion, and we're probably not finished with that. It seems
probably not. How many billions are in a? Let's put it this way: how many $40 billions would equal $1 trillion?
Right. I can't divide that fast, but I would say I would say like 25, 40 billions.
25, 40 billion. Well, I don't think that's the right answer, but you're the engineer and the guy with math, so this should be right up your alley. All right, listeners, someone tell us how many $40 billion NASA budgets would be in $1 trillion bailout dollars. That would be an interesting little number. Now, don't go do math like CNN does. We want real math here. So
I don't think I was wrong with 25, but let the audience do
well,
it. Is it
well, you multiply 25 times 40, would you get $1 trillion?
Well, 25 times 40. maybe 250.
Yes, I think you're short. I think it would.
Yeah, I think maybe 250.
All right, so there's got to be a brilliant mathematician out there who can run that for us on your cell phone and email it or call us and let us know. Do you think these efforts, like this, like the executive order, which by the way does have some international blowback to it, and this draft on mining the moon for the International Artemis Accords? I wasn't even familiar with the International Artemis Accords. Do you think that these things are really going to take root? And do they need a broader audience than just the United States and maybe Luxembourg and Abu Dhabi? Or, you know, it seems to me like there's kind of resistance to some of these White House moves.
Yeah, I would expect there would be. I mean, we have a long history of treaties for the moon since the 60s. And we had the underwater treaty that the U.S. didn't sign.
Right.
So I think that one of the Trump orders basically allowed companies to retain title to whatever they bring back from space. So if they go mining on the moon, and whatever they can bring back, they own. All of the original moon treaty from 67, I think, said that basically the moon is common ground and nobody can own anything. And we know that unless there are some agreements between countries as to what the rules are for going to the moon and creating cities and doing stuff there, nobody's going to do it because nobody's going to expend hundreds of billions of dollars to build a city on the moon and then not own it. So that's the challenge. But I think you're right. I think that and legal experts, I believe, would say that you have to have agreements on these kinds of things. But I believe what the Trump administration is doing is it's entering into agreements with either one or two or three nations at a time rather than as a worldwide kind of treaty.
Right, miniature sort of multilateral agreements.
Right.
By the way, I just ran it, and you are correct. It is 25. So,
okay.
you'd have 25 billion, 40 billions to get to 1 trillion.
Right. And we've spent 3 trillion.
Or a little more than 3 trillion, and more is forthcoming. So,
right.
That's a lot of NASA budgets.
Yeah.
And actually, the NASA budget's really only about $23 billion. So we're assuming they double it, like you said would be needed, you know, in your earlier remarks. But they really haven't doubled it. So if it's really only $20 billion, for example, then you need a lot more NASA budgets in there.
That's right. And as we said, you can only push technology so fast. Just because you pour money into it doesn't mean you can do all the research and development in a shorter amount of time.
Do you think the American people want us to go back to the moon? Do they want us to go back to the moon enough to where it's okay to spend this kind of money, or do they don't care and they're tuned out and focused on other things, which are probably far more important to them right now? Or if they started seeing in the press the price tag for going to the moon and doing this or that, would they bolt? Would they say, we can't afford this right now?
Well, I think it's sort of a love-hate relationship, right? When they see rovers driving on Mars, everybody gets excited. And then when they see all these concepts and science fiction movies about cities on the moon, cities on Mars, you know, all kinds of spacecraft flying through the solar system, I think it's intellectually they like it. But they also overestimate what the NASA budget is. People who are asked who don't know what the budget is, they'll say it's like maybe 5% of the national budget, whereas it's actually about half a percent, if that anymore. So I think intellectually people like the idea. You know, if you're American, you like to see American technology succeed, and space is a big adventure and is a very positive vision of the future. So I think they do, But like you said, well, obviously now space is not really at the top of very many minds. Getting through this is sort of priority one all around. But even before this, people will many times not say that space is number one on the list of what they think is important for society. You know, there's poverty, there's homelessness, there's the national debt. There's so many things that are viewed as much more critical. But I think also at the same time, if you have a discussion with people one-on-one or in a small group, you know, and you talk about how important it is to invest in the future, just like we save a little bit of our salary for a rainy day, we want to invest in the future. So we invest in science, we invest in technology because technology and science basically leverage that money. That money becomes multiplied by 1,000 or 1,000,000 to go into the future. You know, creates new industries, creates new jobs. It saves lives through medical science. So I think if you have that kind of discussion with people, they will tend to agree that spending a small portion of the national budget on long-range planning in the sciences and medicine are really a good way to spend at least part of the national budget.
Listeners, so many of you may not have heard of the International Artemis Accords, and so I urge you to check it out. So I'm going to read you a short paragraph so that you'll know what we're talking about from a Reuters article. The Artemis Accords, named after NASA's new Artemis mission program, propose safety zones that would surround future moon bases to prevent damage or interference from rival countries or companies operating in close proximity. The pact also aims to provide a framework under international law for companies to own the resources they mine. In the coming weeks, the U.S. officials plan to formally negotiate the accords with space partners including Canada, Japan, the European countries, as well as the United Arab Emirates, opening talks with countries that the Trump administration sees as having like-minded interests in lunar mining. Russia, a major partner with NASA on the space station, will not be an early partner in these accords, as the Pentagon increasingly views Moscow as hostile for making threatening satellite maneuvers toward the U.S. satellites in orbit. Well, the article goes on and on and on, and up until I received this article earlier today, I was not even aware of the U.S.-sponsored International Artemis Accords. But coming on the heels of the Trump administration executive order for lunar mining and property rights, this seems natural and really important. And you've been writing books and talking about lunar structures and habitats. This is made to order for you. So how do you see we prepare for doing some kind of mining on the moon? Because we don't have any prep for it right now. We don't have any mining equipment. We don't have any habitat. We don't even have a rocket yet to take us there.
Right. I agree with you that this is really, it appears premature. Maybe the administration is trying to set up the legal framework and basis for something that may happen in 20 years. That's a possibility. Maybe it's a way to focus activities, engineering research activities, to develop some of these technologies. But like you said, you know, mining on the moon, any sort of large-scale operations on the moon, whether it's digging or building, is very different than it would be on the Earth because of the gravity differences and also because of the toxicity and the toxicity of the regolith, as well as the fact that the regolith would degrade any sort of machinery on the lunar surface. So there are a lot of issues on doing what they're laying the groundwork for here.
Pretty interesting. So if you were to do a timeline, well, let me do it this way. If we actually were a go on all of this and the organizational structure were in place and the funding mechanisms were in place, what would be our TRL for actually producing the hardware and the systems to accomplish lunar mining, for example. Let's take for granted we've got the organizational part worked out.
Okay. I guess there's a TRL for getting there, the rockets and that sort of thing. And that seems to be moving, pretty well, thanks to Blue Origin, SpaceX, and NASA to some extent, obviously. But the actual hardware for digging, I think, is behind the technology for getting us there. There are still unanswered questions about how do you deal with the lunar regolith. We know that the regolith is very, very, very small particles, very jagged, can be inhaled very deeply into your lungs. We know from Apollo that it got tracked into the spacesuits and into the capsules, even though everything was sealed. It caused a lot of degradation of moving parts. So unless we have a way by which we can contain these particles or keep them away from our machinery and our lungs, we have serious issues there. People have been doing work for quite a while on how to excavate on the moon. So that's a challenge. So because of the challenge, people have tried to go to other technologies in order to have different methods by which we can extract, for example, hydrogen, oxygen, water from the surface that don't involve major digging.
So you're going to give it fairly low TRLs as of May 5th, 2020. Is that what I'm hearing? Okay.
Yeah, I would say so.
So there was another article that I know you read, and maybe listeners read it, I don't know. It was in a recent copy, April 27th of this year, in Popular Mechanics by Joe Pappalardo. I'm working on seeing if Joe will come back on the space show and talk about it. Digging Up Regolith, Why Mining the Moon Seems More Possible Than Ever. So if you read his excellent article, it's as if the wish list thinking of lunar mining resources, water on the moon, has everything is borne out. It's just as the space advocates and space cadets say it is. It's all there just waiting for us. And so I'd like to sort of get an assessment and see if we can look at what we know factually about lunar resources and water and what's at the poles and water ice and what the hype and what all the fantasy and the wish list kind of thinking is, because I think there's some big gaps between what we factually already know and what many people believe and then assume is actually there, but it may not be there, or it may not be accessible, or it may not be affordable to access it. Do we have a gap in what we factually know about lunar resources and what people say, and like what's in this Popular Mechanics article? Because I know you've read the article too.
Right. So so this article just came out end of last month, and basically talks about all the opportunities for accessing water on the moon. They're focusing primarily on the South Pole, as NASA has been for quite a while, and basically laying the groundwork for eventually sending robotic miners and as a prelude to astronauts coming there. And these robots would dig and would access the regolith and go through chemical processes to extract the elements that might be needed to set up the first colony.
Yeah, but none of this is in place. None of this is even proven out. There's not even a piece of hardware for this. How do we know that when we are able to evolve into technology that it would even be close to what's being written about in this article and many other? I'm not hitting on Joe, but many other articles that are like this. I mean, to me, it's like a vision of the future, but there really isn't a lot to base it on as a plausible vision of the future. Or am I being too hard-ass?
No, I think you're being accurate. I think there's sort of two different things that are going on here. One is through a number of spacecraft, they have shown that there's a possibility of there being water in the South Pole, as well as more recently all around the lunar surface, at least by doing spectrographs and getting different ways by which they can guess that the elements are there for there to be large volumes of water in different forms. So even in this century, we had the Deep Impact, we had the Japanese Kaguya probe, Chang'e, the Indian probes. They all sort of mapped out the lunar surface and said that there probably is water. They think that there's a lot of water on the South Pole. But so that's the first part of it. The second part is, what do you do with it, and how do you deal with it? If we're talking about the South Pole, we know that there are real issues of actually putting a settlement in the South Pole. We know that it's very rocky. We know that we don't have the technology to do that. We don't have robots that can actually, that we can send to the moon and actually do what we're talking about here. So that's a real challenge. So we talked about the regolith problem, but on the South Pole, you have the added problem that it's very rocky. Some of the concepts say we're going to have a facility in the deep recesses of the South Pole, and then another facility at the top of the ridge, and they're going to connect and they're going to mine and extract whatever needs to be extracted. But it's really hard to do that. And even putting humans at the South Pole in a facility would be really challenging. We know that at the South Pole, the sun is almost always somewhere around the horizon, which makes mobility very difficult. We blind the astronauts. So there are a lot of very practical issues, as well as the fact that a lot of the technology that we're claiming that we can use really isn't there today. And quite frankly, I don't know that the South Pole makes sense from many perspectives for people to be on the moon.
From your perspective, what makes sense? Where would you want to be on the moon?
I think I would want to be on the moon where perhaps around the where the Apollos were. I'd like to be on the moon somewhere in a large expanse, not really caged in some valley that is essentially dark all the time. I think that if some of the reports say that there really is water throughout the surface of the moon, as some of the reports say, then I would say we would try to find one of those locations in a more hospitable part of the surface.
And can we do that today? Can we at least hone in on those locations?
Technologically?
Yeah. I mean, do we have the technical capability, the analysis, where we can pinpoint the precise places to be on the surface of the moon?
We can pinpoint the precise areas, and I would bet there are maps that give you, you know, locations of high probability where you'd like to find more water. However, you know, the whole plan for getting people back to the moon required precursor missions to map out specific sites that were being considered, do some drilling, figure out what's really there, check out the soil before we send people. So that there are precursor missions that are required before you send people to the moon.
And how are we doing on that one?
we're not doing any of that yet, right? So we don't have the precursors going. So this brings us back to, you know, the date 2024. You know, you may be able to send people to the moon to land like the Apollo, but they're going to have to come right back. You know, they're not going to be able to do anything. We have to send a spacecraft before these people arrive, so they have a place to stay more permanently for a few months. I don't see any of that. You know, I don't see any concepts for lunar facilities that are well developed and human tested, and that we're comfortable sending to the moon before astronauts get there, and then have the astronauts live there for a month, say, before coming back to the Earth. I believe almost all the concepts really say that the first settlements on the moon will be rotating like we have on the space station. It may be many years after that initial landing on the moon before we have people who are going to be there, quote-unquote, permanently.
So, but, But
many layers here.
Yeah, it's hard for me to get excited because I don't see. This is why I said the action seems to be coming out of the White House. I don't see the prep work to lay any of the groundwork. Now, you were with me at ISDC last year, and we heard NASA and Scott say, Bridenstine and Scott say, that the way they'd go to the moon to meet the president's directive for 2024 was they'd go touch down, open the door, jump out, touch the ground, go right back up to the gateway. That's their plan for 2024. You heard that as well as I did at ISDC, and I think that's the only thing technically that they're capable of doing, and even that, we may not be able to do that on 2024.
Not if you're including Gateway. I mean, is Gateway, sometimes Gateway is on, sometimes it's off. I don't know where Gateway is.
I don't either. But, well, if you don't include Gateway, then you got to make an Apollo mission to the moon, and then I guess you have to return because you have no way to stay on the moon, and if Gateway's not there, then what are you going to do after you've locked the door and lifted off of the surface of the moon because you have no capability to stay there?
Right.
So
that's the problem. You know, the problem is that we want to get there so eagerly that we never get to the point where we have a logical long-term plan to build capabilities. You know, if they did that after the end of Apollo, then by today we would have cities on the moon. But, you know, I think we're always too eager to get there, and we're not willing to put the groundwork in to build the logical progression of technologies that will allow us to stay there and really build facilities that will be there forever.
So I'd be a lot more excited about the potential if I saw us doing the needed infrastructure and basic work to get us there, even 2028. Is pretty close by when you have nothing even underway at the moment.
Right. And don't forget, in the 60s, when Kennedy wanted to go to the moon before the end of the decade, NASA was taking up 5% of the American budget. So yeah. 5%, that would be today a NASA budget of 10 times what we have. That would be like $200 billion a year instead of $20 billion a year. That's, by percentage-wise, that you'd have to... It would be the same 5% of the national budget, but it would get you to a 10 times larger budget that NASA would need to do it in 10 years. And even then, it would be almost impossible to do.
I have your first listener email. And listeners, I hope you'll use the phone and call and talk to Chaim, 1-866-687-7223. Joe is in Austin, Texas, and he said, Dr. Benaroya, I'm assuming you also know Dr. Logan, as does David, and he always says you'll know when this country and NASA are getting serious about putting humans beyond low Earth orbit when you see them actually trying to figure out the gravity prescription for humans beyond low Earth orbit. Since that is not happening, let alone any of what you've been talking about for 30 minutes happening, I too am not excited because nobody knows the gravity prescription for humans to spend any amount of time on the moon other than an Apollo-like mission. Are they going to come up with some sort of artificial gravity and at what level? There have been no efforts to test for 1/6 gravity, Martian gravity, or anything in between. There's no hardware to do it. There's no way to do it on Earth effectively. And there's no mechanism or support or hardware to do it in space. So I conclude this is all a bunch of huff and puff BS, and we're not going anywhere. Am I too harsh?
Well, you know, Joe has a great point. You know, in other shows, you and I have talked about this, the fact that medical doctors don't know what the threshold is for the human body to survive effectively in other than 1G. Like, is it an on-off kind of thing? Like, would 0.8G work? We don't know. And the moon is 1/6 G. Mars is 3/8 G. When you're traveling in between the Earth and Mars for almost a year, you're at 0 G unless you have a rotating spacecraft. So that's a real question. I mean, some people say it may not be artificial gravity, but maybe it'll be gene therapy. Maybe they have to rewire us so that it works. But of course, The reality is we don't understand how to do that. Otherwise, we would have done it. And, I mean, I'm not up to date on any of the research in these areas, and I assume NASA has medical doctors that, maybe I'm wrong, that are studying these things and worry about the gravity effects, but I don't know. I don't know where that is, really. But I think that's sort of the point that Joe's making, is that we don't hear about any of these studies that say that we can actually go ahead and make people survive in anything other than 1G.
Well, we stay up on it, and we do programs on it all the time, especially gene modification. So for medical purposes and research, there's an awful lot of very exciting gene modification research and gene therapy going on. Not so much for space. There are rodents that do gravity experiments, you know, little tiny mice and rats that are up on the space station and in other kind of simulation projects. But if one wanted to satisfy Dr. Logan's requirements for determining the gravity prescription, since he is the standard I personally always cite when this subject comes up, I think we'd be a long, long way from satisfying Dr. Logan's standards. But I can't speak for him, and you know him as well as I do, and I don't know if you feel that you could speak for him, but I think he'd say we're not serious because we're not putting any real effort out to do this. So I don't want to be a total Debbie Downer here, because I think it is plausible to get back to humans on the moon. I'm kind of skeptical of 2024, and I'm also skeptical of that because we're in a presidential year, by the way. But
just one more comment about the gravity. So I would say, even if we don't understand how gravity works as far as the human body for very long-term stays on the moon, we do have some examples from the space station, which is more microgravity. And quite frankly, since I really don't expect the first people to go back to the moon to stay there for hugely extensive periods of time, probably less than the time that people spend on the space station. You know, they may go there for a few months and come back to Earth. And so in that case, then they would probably be better off than the astronauts we have in the space station, who stay for 6 months, 9 months, and 12 months, and then have to be carried out on the stretcher when they get back to Earth. So we probably can survive for months at a time. And maybe, as your caller said, once we're on the moon, maybe we can start doing some experiments and just see what happens, and start learning a little bit at a time what happens to ourselves as we are on the moon, what happens to all of our body as it adjusts to that environment. So we can get data that way.
Well, yeah, so maybe one of the first things you do when you go back to the moon is you have a facility to test for 1,6G or something in between. And
right.
maybe that's how you do it, because clearly they're not going to do it on the space station, and they're not
right.
going to do it on a module near the space station. So
right.
maybe the best way to do it is to go back to the moon. I do believe all of this is plausible. I'm not sure about the 2024 timeline. I'm a little more comfortable that something could take place by 2028. I'm less assured that the national will and the political will of the country is going to see it through. We typically change horses in the middle of the stream every time we have an election. So I don't know why this election would be any different, but maybe it will be. But I really think that the moon, getting back there and doing the things that Joe talks about in his Popular Mechanics article and others is really crucial to our future.
Well, I agree. I agree completely.
And would be really uplifting if we were actually working on this and seeing progress on it and things, rather than our daily dose of COVID crap.
And the other thing I would add is that sometimes people think about going to the moon and putting people there as being a very narrow focus activity, as though it has no effect on the rest of society. But we know that every technology that's developed has numerous spin-offs, not just in space technology, but any kind of technology, numerous spin-offs into civilian sectors, large multiplier effects, creates new companies, creates jobs, just accelerates progress in society And space is one of those areas where the spin-offs are huge. The motivation factor is huge. We know that during Apollo era, the number of students who went to graduate school in the STEM fields multiplied by 4, 5, 6 people went to study math PhDs, engineering PhDs, and they didn't do it because they wanted to go into space. They did it because they were excited about what science and engineering can do, and they wanted to be a part of it. So all these things that are really hard to quantify, although some of that I just mentioned was quantified in the 60s by econometric models, all this stuff, you know, has a huge impact and benefit to society. So going to the moon may cost $100 billion or $200 billion, but in the greater economy, it could result in $1 trillion of growth over the same period of time that we're spending to go to the moon.
Well, it could help get us out of our debt, maybe, if it's really as lucrative as people would say. Helen is in Las Vegas with an email, and she says, we have a caller, but the caller can stay on hold for just a minute. Helen says that NASA experts and other scientists and academics claim that the mass of the moon is huge in terms of oxygen. I think it's reported to be between 40-45% of oxygen, and launching oxygen is expensive. So they talk about splitting water, which would be the lunar ice or the water on the moon, into hydrogen and oxygen, and then being able to make propellant. I'm assuming that chemists and scientists know how to do this on Earth and have done this on Earth, but how hard is it to do this on the moon, or would it be the same mechanisms and the same chemical and engineering and scientific processes as we do on Earth?
Right. So that's a very good point. And you're right. It's something like 40% oxygen, something like that. There are two parts to this, right? So the first part is just the physics of it, you know, and the chemistry of it. Like, what does it take to take a hydrogen or a water molecule and split it up? And how do you extract an element from a material? These are all physics-based things. So the engineering part of it is building a machine that can do it. And how that machine operates will be different on the moon than it would be on Earth. So on the moon, obviously, there's the vacuum, there's the low gravity. There are radiation effects on the surface of the moon that aren't shielded because there's no atmosphere. So there are the practicalities that the engineers who design these systems, these physical systems to do what you're describing, will be different than they would be on the Earth.
If you were the engineer and they said, "Doc, give us a process or hardware to split, you know, the lunar water ice at the South Pole into rocket fuel," could you make such a machine today, or how hard would it be to create a machine to do that on the moon?
I think there have been many studies that have conceptualized how that would be done. So I think that's doable. I think it's more chemical engineering than it is structural engineering, but I've read papers that do talk about those processes and do talk about how to do it on the moon, and some practical aspects have already been developed and discussed quite extensively. So I think the processes are there. I think the challenge is getting the infrastructure to the moon that could house these systems that would be required. So if you imagine that you're on the moon and you start processing the regolith or beneath the regolith and you're getting oxygen and hydrogen out of the soil, you know, you're going to have pipes, you're going to have containers to contain these things. They have to be pressurized. Are they going to be exposed to the radiation, or are you going to put them into a bigger structure? If there's a thermal effect, the moon goes from plus 200 to minus 200 degrees, you know, every 2 weeks. You have 2 weeks of daylight, 2 weeks of dark. So there are a lot of things going on beyond what you're trying to do. And so you need a pretty significant infrastructure to house all these things. It's not going to be done robotically. If it is, then it's much more difficult. So that means you're going to have people there if something breaks. I think you see that there's a lot of stuff that goes along with that small piece of equipment that might be able to process the regolith into hydrogen and oxygen.
Can you demo this or test it on Earth, or do you have to sort of work it out as best as possible and then get up there and fine-tune everything on the moon?
Yeah, I think the gravity is not necessarily as big an issue for these kind of processes, because they have their own driving forces, the chemical reactions, the physical processes. Have more significant effect than does gravity for most of them. So I think people have done some of that on Earth. So I think we understand the processes that we have to do. And sometimes you have a more clever machine or more clever engineering process. But the physics of the process and the engineering of the process, I believe, is relatively well understood. But it doesn't operate in isolation. And so there's an infrastructure around that process. And there's a large infrastructure to do what you want to do, especially if you have people that are going to maintain it and repair things. I think we're very far off from autonomous mining. We don't see much autonomous mining on the Earth. We don't see autonomous construction of structures. People point to 3D printing as a way to do things on the moon, and you can design a robot on Earth and show how the prototype works. But on the Earth, it's very different than on the moon for many reasons that we've already mentioned. So I think it's very hard to do something in isolation on the moon. There's going to be an infrastructure around that, and as you know, on Earth, everything requires maintenance and repair. Sometimes things break. That's a big part of what we have to consider when we do something on the moon. So the gradual approach that we were talking before is really the only way to do this. You build incrementally, and you build on capabilities. Once you're on the moon, you can start understanding the processes better, both for the human body as well as for what you're doing there. We don't have any data at all on reliability of structures on the moon, for example. We've never had a robot on the moon operate. So we can do a lot of the prep here, but there are things that we really can't do on Earth, primarily for the gravity, but also the fact that there are a lot of different effects happening at the same time. You have the lower gravity, you have the radiation, you may have to shield against micrometeorites. So there's a lot of stuff that's going on there that you have to worry about.
I've got another email for you, and let me take the caller first who's been waiting. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program tonight. Who are you and where are you? Thank you for calling.
This is Marshall.
Hi.
When I was listening earlier, one of the things I seem to have missed is the fact that during the Apollo program, we had a competitor. It was Russia. Where's our competitor at present? Because, like you say, not much is happening, and I think it's because we have no competition.
So that's a very good point. I would say that our competitor is China, and perhaps secondarily other countries, maybe the European Union, maybe Japan, maybe South Korea, maybe India. All these countries have evolving space programs, but I would say the ones that are closest to capabilities that we have would be the Chinese, and so that's a valid point. You know, would our program be more accelerated if we thought that the Chinese would be able to land on the moon in 5 years with people and start building there? So I think you're right. I think that would accelerate us. But you know, we really know that they are going to do that. So I don't know. I don't know if even that would be enough to actually push us. Somehow we tend to operate behind the curve on these things in many ways. We really need it sort of to be facing some sort of existential threat, in quotes, before we actually believe it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our space program started because of the advances in the Russian, in the Soviet space program, right, with Sputnik and Gagarin. That, so it had to happen first before we believed it. Even though we probably knew that it was going to happen, it wasn't enough to know it. It had to happen. So maybe that's what, what's going to happen here.
That's generally my thought. America is full of very smart people, but, you know, bless our little hearts, unless there's some competition, we just really don't go after it.
Yeah, I agree with you. And even though intellectually we can, like you said, and intellectually we know that there are competitors out there that really aren't that far behind us.
Yeah, and we basically need to get going, and we can't let the politicians decide how to do things. We, the engineers, have to do it. So, that's my comment for this evening.
What are you drinking tonight as you're sheltered in on your Oklahoma farm, Marshall? Marshall?
Drinking. Well, let's see. Just my black cherries, no calorie, no caffeine, no anything, evening drink. I'm sorry, I'm not really drinking anything.
I don't know. It just sounds like you're a little delusional. Let the engineers do it and not to hell with the politicians.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm one of the engineers. I'm wanting to
do it. I agree with Marshall. I think that engineers should be in charge. But, you know, the problem is engineers aren't very good at politics usually.
Do you think politicians are good at politics?
No, but politicians are good at getting
I have to agree with David. From what I've seen in the last 6 months, none of them are impressing me a bit. Anyway,
I'm not impressed. They just know how to get power and keep it.
Well, I'm not sure that they're going to succeed at that either. But until next time.
Thank you, Marshall.
Yeah. Thank you.
Listeners, you can call and chime in after Marshall's call. He's he's gone back to his black cherry juice. 1-866-687-7223. You have a question from another Heim. Do you think recent success of private companies, SpaceX, Blue Origin, and such will make lunar and Mars expedition cheaper?
So that's a good question. We see that there's been a lot of progress, right, with Blue Origin, with SpaceX, until recently Virgin Galactic, maybe Bigelow Aerospace. I think it will be cheaper. I think, though, one has to realize that there's a very big difference between unmanned space technology and technology meant to carry people. And so the next challenge for SpaceX, for example, or Blue Origin, is to get their spacecraft to be rated for human travel. And that's a big challenge. However, as a general principle, I would think commercial space travel would be much more effective and efficient over time than, government-based space travel. I would put that as a general principle.
SpaceX is giving it a shot to the space station. I think it's May 27th.
Yeah. So, well, I hope that it works.
Obviously, we all are hoping that it will be
working. That's sort of the test for them.
Uh-huh. I think SpaceX rocket development is probably far more efficient and more ahead of expected dates. It's still behind, but I mean it's more ahead than SLS, for example.
Right. But one point that I always like to make when we talk about commercial space travel, all these commercial companies have been sitting on the shoulders of government-developed technologies, with rare exceptions. So a lot of the scientific research, a lot of the engineering research, a lot of the first prototypes, they were all government.
Right.
That's the natural order of things. Many technologies that we depend on today started off as government technology, like the Internet, for example. So I think that's okay. I don't mind that. I mean, that's what we want government. We want government to develop certain things, certain technologies, and then have companies take them and take them to the next level, make them efficient, respond to market forces, respond to consumer demand. So I think that's the natural order. So it's hopeful, actually, that we do have companies like this. Ironically, in some sense, all billionaire-run companies, because nobody else could be able to afford to do this kind of thing.
Absolutely. Listeners, we're at the top of the hour. I'm going to take a pause, and I'm going to use this to thank our sponsors real quickly. And then we'll pick up on the other side of that with the second segment of tonight's program. You can give us a call, and I'll put you on hold as I'm reading sponsor messages. Our toll-free number is 866-687-7223. And email drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. And we will be back in a couple of minutes with Dr. Ben Roya. Chaim, don't hang up the phone. And if you need to go get your black cherry Oklahoma moonshine from Marshall, this would be a good time to go do that.
I should give him my address.
He can telepathically get it to you at the speed of light. You know, these farmers can do miracle things. Listeners, we do have sponsors, and as I said, they really make a difference for the space show. We're deeply appreciative of them. Northrop Grumman is a sponsor, and they are a leading global security company with innovative, cool systems, products, solutions. They go from undersea to space and cyberspace. We're deeply appreciative of their banner ad and their sponsorship. The Space Foundation, you've all heard me say that they had to cancel their symposium, which was March 30th to April 2nd because of COVID-19. And you can find out more about their rescheduling plans or how they're going to work at spacesymposium.org. If you've never been to one, you need to be at one. The exhibition hall is unbelievable. The networking, the people that attend, I mean, it's really a first-rate, very unusual, high-quality space conference. Astrox sponsors us. Astrox has been involved in hypersonic space plane and reusable rocket designs for the Air Force, DARPA, and NASA for more than 30 years. Their proprietary codes, HiSight and SpaceSight, create and analyze the designs. Visit Astrox.com for more information. AIAA sponsors us, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, the world's largest aerospace professional society. You do not have to be an engineer. You can join it at AIAA.org. They have decades of peer-reviewed papers that you can access. They have five major conferences or events a year and lots of regional meetings. They're doing things virtually right now because of the virus. It's a great organization. Everybody should be part of it. The American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, AIAA. MoonWords sponsors us. What if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon and they based their decisions only on technical and economic merit? MoonWords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit MoonWords.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. Celestis sponsors us. We've been talking about the moon. Do you know that Celestis has already had one lunar burial mission? And they have another one coming up. Right now, it's on the books for fourth quarter 2021. But you can also have your loved one's ashes with your DNA, by the way, sent to orbit or do suborbital. Lots of options, and it's a great way to memorialize someone that you have lost. I have done it several times with my mom and my two dogs. And, mom and the two dogs are going to the moon with Celestis. So I'm a big fan of Celestis. They're a great company, CELESTIS.com. And if this is something of interest to you, check it out. The National Space Society sponsors us. ISDC was canceled this year, but it'll be rolled into part of ISDC 2021 in Los Angeles. And everybody should attend. It's probably going to be a spectacular event. Their website, space.nss.org. And then the Integrated Space Plan. This is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a space-faring race. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. On the internet version of the space plan, the virtual elements expand into a lot more detail. You can also buy your own copy. It comes in two different sizes and varieties. All of this information is available at the, T-H-E, spaceplan, all one word, .com. And we would not be doing this program without our great sponsors and their banner ads. If you're interested in being a spatial sponsor, get a hold of me. Remember, since your ads and messages are on all these archive programs, they're out there getting name impressions for you and your business in perpetuity, or as close to perpetuity as you're ever going to find. What a bargain. So Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com. And Chaim, I know you have always wanted to come to Southern California, and we have actually talked about meeting there. ISDC is going to be in Los Angeles in 2021. So
okay,
this is your opportunity to come back and speak at the moon track, and then spend a few days tooling down, and we can go to Mount Palomar and do some of the things we've talked about.
Sounds good. I'll look for the notice. Have they announced the call for papers yet?
Probably. Go to space.nss.org, you know, their website, and look for their ISDC announcements. I don't know if they've started announcing for 2021, but they have folded ISDC 2020 this year into 2021. They had to cancel it due to the virus, and they're not going to reschedule it or do anything
right
with it this year. So it'll
I enjoyed it in Washington.
Yeah, except we were stuck at a crappy hotel that was out in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, so, but this will be different. It'll be L.A., and we can take off, and I'll come down, and I'd love to go to have a special space show tour of Mount Palomar. I've always wanted to go there. And we can go over to the Griffith Observatory. They're great friends of mine. You've never been there. You'll really love it. And you can go see all the old ancient telescopes. And, I mean, it's really, you'll have a great time.
Okay.
Venice
we'll plan on it.
I can take you down to Venice Beach. And
okay.
We'll get you a skateboard or a rollerblade so that you'll be right in with everybody. And
sounds like fun.
And amber sunglasses and shorts and...
Maybe we can do a space show from the beach.
Possibly. Maybe the virus crap will be over with, and we can actually relate and talk to people and not get arrested. So we'll
at least not for that, right?
Yeah, well, let's hope for the best. You have a caller kicking off segment two. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program tonight. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you very much for your call.
This is John in Fort Worth.
Hi, John in Fort Worth. How are you?
Pretty good. And one thing that sort of always concerns me about this Artemis-type program, which is the degree to which this has the feel of just another Apollo all over again. I mean, we really need, if we're going to do something on the moon, we really need to develop a lunar transportation system that's designed to maintain a sustained effort, you know, I mean, as opposed to, I guess, the SpaceX entry, if that really were accepted. Or at least that's I guess it's a development thing, but if it were to go that way, maybe that would give you that capability. But, I mean, you know, that's kind of one of my thoughts. We need to develop more like reusable systems to do this with and to maintain our position on the moon if we're going to do something more than just gotta go there and do a little exploration and come back, and that's that.
Lame, do you have any commentary?
I totally agree. I think until we have a reusable technology, it's just not feasible. The space shuttle was supposed to do some of that, and it was redesigned to the point where it cost almost $1 billion to take a flight into low Earth orbit. So I think maybe SpaceX will do it. it sort of relates to what we were talking about earlier about the fact that industry may be able to mass produce these things and maybe make it affordable. But I think beyond that, that has to be tied to a developing economy on the moon. Unless there's a reason to go to the moon, science won't be enough, even though we all love science. There has to be something that creates wealth on the moon, whatever that is. You know, maybe it's experiments, maybe it's resource mining, maybe it's tourism. There has to be wealth created on the moon if we're going to have a long-term presence on the moon. Otherwise, it's going to always be, the reality of it is that SpaceX and Blue Origin and all these commercial space companies, they really depend on the taxpayer, right?
Hold on. John, can you do something with your phone? It's gone to all static. I don't know. Can you hit it or slap it on the floor or do something? Maybe you can knock it, some sense into it. It's all we're getting is static from you now.
I'll call back.
All right, call back. Okay.
So what I was saying is that we can have a reusable launch system to the moon, you know, whatever you can imagine, you know, a great cheap reusable launch system. But unless it's a purpose to go to the moon, whatever it might be, it's not going to be enough. You have to have something that generates wealth on the moon.
Do we know what that wealth-generating thing is likely is, or do we have to get there first?
We have some ideas. You know, I think eventually, people would love to go to the moon, right? If you can get to the point where people like you and me, David, can get to the moon, we would do it, even if it was not too cheap. So tourism, I think, is eventually viable. I think some kind of mining activity that doesn't offend people because it destroys the moon would be something acceptable. Maybe as a station, a location where we would create fuel for other rockets that maybe go to the outer solar system or to Mars. For science is a part of this also. Research on human survivability in space, all these things may add up to the possibility that we're creating more wealth than it costs to go there. That seems to be, to me, sort of a condition for a self-sustaining space civilization. If it costs more, if we're spending more money to get there than we can make while we're there, then it's a negative balance, and you can only spend money so far. So you need to have some positive net creation of wealth, otherwise it's not viable, no matter how cheap it is to get there.
John?
Yeah, well, I tend to agree with that. I guess the other thing that always kind of makes me nervous about this whole thing and reusable systems, though, is depending on where they come from, is develop something that you have the reliability for human spaceflight to do that. Especially if you're talking about something that, say, goes from I don't know, the gateway to the lunar surface or some other station near the moon, you know, and you're refueling it somewhere, like in orbit or at some, you know, some orbit around the moon, et cetera, whatever system is put in place. That also gives me a little bit of nervousness, you know.
And I totally agree with you on that as well. Reliability of space systems is a number one issue. It affects everything. It affects whether people who fly rockets can get insurance. People who put satellites in orbit get insurance based on reliability calculations. And the challenge with reliability calculations for the lunar surface is we don't know. Right? We can only guess. And so, and those reliability calculations come with incremental activity. Like, the more we do, the more data we have on how reliable something is. Like, for example, how long will a rover last on the moon that you're building on Earth? We don't know, right? We can guess, and we may be within 30-40%, but that might not be good enough when you're talking about humans as being part of that equation.
Right, because that's it seems like every time there's a fatal accident involving human spaceflight, at least with a NASA program, it immediately goes into a major soul-searching study that delays everything for years. And
right.
It
it's not I like, think we need to like, get to the point like the airplanes. Like when a commercial airplane crashes, we still, you know, study the hell out of what happened. But the rest of the planes still take off that morning.
Yeah. So it is. That's another thing that we. Part of the reason I think for that though is that space programs have been so tied into national prestige, unlike just airplane programs tend to be. And the NASA programs have had that history going out of the competition with the Russians back in the 60s. And you know, I think that's one reason why that's done too. And
right, space is very different than flying, but. Early on, flying was very similar to what we have with space now, right? It was either more like an expedition, or it was for the very wealthy initially. And you figure within what, like 60 years, 50 years, you had the commercial aircraft flying. Now, obviously, space is more complicated, but it has to get to that point in order for it to be self-perpetuating.
Yeah, so that's one of the factors we have to look at. Well, right now it looks like. Well, I don't know, what do you think of the three different concepts that have been selected by NASA so far? For further study is what it really comes down to. And I mean,
right. They're gonna pick one at the end of the contract. It's really hard to say. I mean, there's really not enough information to assess it from an engineering point of view. I mean, I think all these companies are very competent. But I think some of the issues you bring up are really the critical ones. You know, how do you assess a concept and tie it to some sort of reliability? There are a lot of issues that go into the design of these structures, and I think that you can't pick it based on just computer models, right? We know how bad computer models can be from this virus we're having, but. So computer models are only good as the data you put into it, and so I think these companies are going to have to build their hardware, go through testing, get a lot of data on reliability of the components of the whole system. They're going to have to do human factor studies, and I think their concepts, all their concepts, are really going to evolve as this goes forward, in order to address some of the real concerns that NASA might have, as well as how the engineers within those companies may change their ideas as the testing goes on. So I don't have a particular favorite there. I think the only favorite I have is that we shouldn't use Gateway as an initial concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the Gateway is tied pretty much to the use of the SLS Orion in its, what, Block 1 format or something like that for the SLS. And it seems like that was... They needed the Delta V they had to get there. You had to do something like that, right? That's why they come up with that orbit.
Right.
So if we had a more robust system, like the full SLS Block 2, we wouldn't be in that particular jam. But the SpaceX Starship derivative idea is interesting. Of course, it kind of depends on the success of SpaceX Starship.
Right.
If that succeeds, that's a whole revolutionary thing, and if it doesn't succeed, well, it's a complete bust. I mean, it's kind of the way I look at that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that these concepts can be made to work, but with anything this complicated, there are all kinds of competing suboptimal decisions that have to be made. And I think that the challenge will be to optimize the whole system, and I bet you that they will optimize in different ways. And the challenge will be to get it to the point where it's affordable and it's reliable, and it does what it's supposed to do. And a lot of that can be hard to tell for a while. I'm not sure that really. What are the contracts that these companies got, David? Were they like 1 year contracts or 2 year contracts?
No, I think they're a little longer. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, I would guess it has to be pretty quick, right? If we're talking 2024, I don't know if these are going to be part of that architecture.
I don't know that either, but
yeah
2024 is if they're really serious about that, and again, I don't think they are, but. it's coming up awfully quick. I mean, we're yeah. almost halfway through 2020, and
yeah.
this is going to be a year that's largely lost for a lot of reasons.
Right, right.
I sort of have the impression, and this isn't a slight to any political figure, but making 2024 turns into kind of a almost a vanity project for the current president, and that's going to cause the other party to be trying to be hostile to the program, whereas if you set the date something out there, 2026 maybe, is a compromise or something a little further, that aspect of it might become not as big a deal, and if the program is well in place by the end of the last fiscal year of that administration, if they got reelected, it would still probably go forward and happen. They probably wouldn't cancel it right on the verge of success. You know, just like...
Right. Yeah, I think I agree with you. A few years later wouldn't make a difference from a political point of view.
But it would definitely help to maybe get everybody on board and at the same time, you know, help it get funded and give you more time to do it, too.
Right. And it could be, you know, many times people put short dates on things to invigorate the process. Otherwise, people get sloppy. If something is so far out into the future, nobody really feels like they have to work very hard.
Well, when we were at ISDC last year and they gave us an idea of what meeting the 2024 President Trump deadline was, I mean, there was a gasp in the room. I mean, I know at the table I was sitting at, that just sounded like pure BS. I mean, that caught me off guard. I was not prepared to hear them say to me, the 2024 goal where it will go down and we'll land and we'll open the capsule and we'll walk around for an hour or so and then we'll have to leave again. I mean, come on. That's not going back to the moon.
No, it's not.
Total crap.
In fact, I think that would set us back from going back to the moon in the right way.
Oh, probably. So then there's talk that maybe 2026 is more plausible. 2028 is even more plausible. But again, nothing, like we said in the first few minutes of the program, none of this to make this happen is underway. There's more activity coming out of the White House with these executive orders and the International Artemis program than there is to go work out how to do anything Chaim talked about or gravity prescriptions or anything. There's nothing even being worked on, and I don't know what's being designed. Maybe stuff is being designed, but I have to tell you, it just seems to me that the action is all huff and smuff and fluff talk, and it's disappointing. I'm not seeing anybody do what it's necessary to do to take on this big program by 2024, let alone even 2028. When are they going to start? You know, they're going to start July 1st, maybe July 4th or July 4th. And of course, we've got the virus that is interfering with all this. So let's just move it up and we'll start in 2021. And yeah, 2024 will still be our landing. I mean, with nothing underway?
Well, I have to assume that stuff is happening at NASA, right? The basic studies, the technologies, the rockets, those kind of things. They must be working with...
Well, maybe. I don't know. We're not... I assume they probably are. I know the planetary missions are still working on them, you know, the planetary exploration. So maybe... you know, the returning to the moon group is doing the necessary groundwork. We don't have any cislunar transportation. You mentioned that earlier in the show, Chaim.
Right.
So I would just feel more comfortable if I saw some metal being bent someplace or something comparable other than, I guess putting the legal and organizational structure in place is really crucial. I'm not downplaying that. So I'm supportive of what the White House is doing. But, I mean, you can walk and chew gum at the same time, right?
Yeah, another concern I have is are the reports of cost overruns and delays.
Well,
and we know that that happens, but it really happens a lot with these kinds of projects. And $1 billion cost becomes $1.5 billion, and it goes from 2 years to 3 years, right? And then in order to make ends meet, they cut back on capabilities, and then all of a sudden you have a space shuttle that doesn't do what it was supposed to do. So.
Well, I just think, for my comfort level, I would like to see more hardcore action underway, or I'd like to be able to read about it and be aware about it. So maybe I'm missing it, and people can point it out to me. But mostly, I just hear concepts and analysis, and now all of this flurry of, I think, needed activity coming from the White House. I think it's all really good, and we do need it. But if we're going to the moon, we got to start bending some metal, or doing something tangible, or figuring out how our people are going to survive, or designing the experiments to figure that out.
Right. I think 2024. What's feasible for 2024 something that can be finished would be sending precursor missions to various select points on the moon to do a site preparation or site test initially, figure out, at least come to a conclusion where we would want to put a settlement. And then in parallel with that, you would do the technology development for the rockets and the landers and the life support systems and the first habitat. You know, those things could be done in parallel. But if we're building the rocket and we're not doing the precursor missions, how does that work?
I don't know. We talked about that earlier. John,
yeah.
Do you have anything more, or should we see if somebody else wants to call us?
Well, I guess we can see. One thing I've been mentioned of, well, these three contracts that have been issued is an example of something substantive, isn't it? I mean, toward this. I mean, that's what you have to do first, isn't it, is, you know, go through the down-select process. Well, they're having three entries.
And Mastin, his lunar lander is supposed to go to the moon in, I think it's 2021. We talked to him on Sunday. So, yeah, they're working on that. So I guess you could say there is some work being done. But if we're going to send humans there,
yeah.
there needs to be some human work there, too. I don't know. Look, I just think...
Well, two of the concepts seem to dovetail with the SLS Orion, and the other one is SpaceX Starship, so that's a whole different system. That's the way it looks to me, anyhow.
I don't think 2024 is going to be very plausible. I really don't.
That date will probably slip. Every other date has slipped. So.
You know, so...
We might actually get somebody in orbit later this month after something that's supposed to be 2017, I believe, and that's a lot less challenging than what we're talking about here.
You're talking about the SpaceX flight, right?
Right. That's the first of the space taxis that was advertised many years ago.
Yeah, so that's scheduled for May 27th.
So, at any rate, well, I'll get clear of the line for the next person.
Thank you very much, John.
Okay, thank you.
Listeners, if you... would like to call and talk to Ben Arroyo, there is still time, despite the fact that we're kind of at the bottom of the hour. But please do call us. We'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number, and I'll get Dr. Ben Arroyo to stick around to see if anybody else wants to call him, 1-866-687-7223. Student-wise at Rutgers, is there a lot of interest in your aerospace engineering students to want to return to the moon? Do they?
Oh, yeah, tremendous, tremendous. I would describe my current senior design group. Some of them are probably listening. They are building a deployable inflatable structure, and I had a master's student who started with that concept, and this senior group is actually building parts of it. So basically, it's like how umbrella opens, you know, it basically lands on the moon. It opens up a panel, so you have like a essentially what looks like a pizza pie open, and then the column then houses the inflatable membrane, which then gets pushed out to create this hemisphere of volume, which can become the first habitat. So students are very interested in this stuff. Many students have told me that they go into engineering because of their interest in space. And Rutgers just started, it's in its second year of an undergraduate aerospace engineering degree. So you have both mechanical and aerospace, both leading to degrees in both those fields. And there's tremendous interest in aerospace.
What about Mars? Are they interested in going to Mars, or is this strictly a lunar play?
I think there's a general interest in space. And so I think Moon, Mars, these are all parts of the attraction to space exploration. I think some of our students build CubeSats. Some of them shoot small rockets above the campus where they're allowed to. So I think there's a lot of general interest in all things space. And a lot of them are really, extremely eager to find positions afterwards, whether it's NASA. We've had several of our students go to NASA, up to JPL, to various aerospace companies, to SpaceX. So we put a lot of our students into these frontline positions that are more space-oriented than mechanical-oriented. So I think, I guarantee you, if there was a really robust space program with a timeline where you would see progress at relatively short periods of time, like 1 to 2 year timeline for achievement, I think you'd see a lot of interest grow, and you'd see a lot of the public much more interested, because you're talking about going to the moon. How long have we talked about going to the moon? And we haven't launched an American astronaut from American soil for like 15 years like 15 years. So how can you keep your interest? I mean, even you and I have a hard time keeping our interest sometimes when we don't have a date for something happening.
Well, the interest is there. The frustration is there. You have a caller on hold. You ready?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to our program tonight. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you very much for calling.
Yeah, this is Tim from Huntsville.
Okay.
Hi, Tim.
Yeah, hey. I was wondering, is any of these three contracts, I guess they're competing for the contract, right?
That's right.
Okay. Are any of them working in conjunction with NASA as far as their kilopower program, the program for making a viable nuclear reactor for space application?
I haven't seen that, David. I don't think that they are, but I could be wrong.
I haven't seen anything. I mean, kilopower is a separate program. I haven't seen any connection of that to this competition. Maybe I missed it. I don't know.
Well, it is a separate program, but it's one that would be vital, as there is a 2-week lunar night. So that would limit their activities. If they didn't have it, it was either that or they would have to be confined to the poles and the peaks of perpetual light. Is that what they're called?
Well, I think you should write them and tell them to get with it, because I've not heard that's even on the drawing board.
Yeah, I think as far as power on the moon, the various concepts, between obviously the solar power during the lunar day, but also storage technologies that NASA's been working for quite a while on, batteries, solar technologies, and using the subsurface as a capacitor. But obviously nuclear power would be one of those concepts, and I'm not sure where NASA is on that. I think they assume that they would have the capability of having a nuclear facility there, a small nuclear power plant, but then you'd have to place it quite far from the facility, where the people are, for obvious reasons.
Well, the thing is, the only way I can see solar power actually working in the long term is if it's in conjunction with fuel cells, because batteries would be the energy to weight ratio would be way too low for it to be practical. The batteries would probably outweigh the solar panels like 10 to 1, at least. I'm guessing off the top of my head, but it takes a lot of batteries just to hold a little bit of power. On the other hand, fuel cells, especially hydrogen oxygen fuel cells, would actually work, but they'd have to start mining the coal traps at the lunar pole for water before they could do that practically.
Right, and that's one of the attractions to the South Pole, is that you have in close proximity regions of near perpetual darkness next to regions that are near perpetual light. So you can generate power that way. So you're pointing to one of the challenges of getting to the moon with people, right? So how do you get them there and have them cycle through a full lunar day and night and have enough power? And that's certainly a challenge. There was a really interesting concept by the Japanese Space Agency where they would have solar panels around the equator, around the whole equator of the moon. So a part of it would always be in sunlight. But, of course, that's not going to happen in the near future.
Oh, no. They need something that's immediate and compact and would be able to function the whole throughout the lunar day and night, and that would be nuclear power. I know that recently NASA just came up with an advanced RTG that actually has a 20% efficiency, which is pretty good because their normal RTG efficiency is around like 3 to 7%. So this is a big improvement. And I could imagine them applying this to a nuclear reactor because one of the big things about mission planning is that they don't like using anything with moving parts. And most reactor designs, including kilopower, do use a heat engine to generate electricity. So anything that you can avoid electricity or avoid moving parts would be a plus for them.
Right. And they know how to build those effectively.
Gentlemen, since you both have referred to the lunar peaks of eternal light, I have a listener who goes ape blank every time this subject comes up and this term comes up, because there is no place on the moon of eternal perpetual light. And he gets bent out of shape all the time.
I think I said near eternal.
Well, near eternal is better. Tim said eternal. But peaks of eternal light are a misnomer because there is no perpetual eternal light anyplace. But, yes, near would be a much more descriptive word. So, Tim, there will probably be a blog post on this from my listener friend. So I will call it to your attention so that you can be forever corrected in future space show programs to get it right regarding the peaks of eternal light at the South Pole.
It sounds
how about peaks
like
of more solar
ceremony.
Energy? Is that better? If I just say peaks of more solar energy.
I think what Haim said is probably more accurate. It's near eternal light, but there is no eternal light. So the only eternal light I know of happens to be in various synagogues and churches where they have an eternal light that goes on forever and ever and ever, plus the eternal light at the tomb of JFK, which goes on even in bad storms and never goes out.
And the tomb of
How about the peak of 70% light?
I'm not qualified to say. I'm just correcting this for listener James. Because I promised I would do it, and I'm not doing a very good job of correcting it. So the next time, I'm going to have my little statement written out so I absolutely get it correct. And I can read the correction on air because I'm kind of botching it. But I'm sure that if he listens to this show on archives, there'll be a blog post, and I will call it to your attention. I'll call it to both of your attentions.
Thanks. That's great.
Tim, do you have anything more? What are you doing for the virus in Huntsville? Are you sheltered in? What's happening? Give us a quick rundown. I haven't talked to anyone from Alabama yet.
No, teleworking, that's it.
Okay. And so you're staying in for the most part?
Yeah, we're staying in for the most part. We're staying in, avoiding the virus that is about as lethal as your typical flu. So, yeah.
I'm not even going to go down that road. But keep in mind, you're talking to Mr. 70, almost 4-year-old geezer plus here. So it may not be very lethal for you, a young guy, but apparently for we codgers, especially as we all get older, we all seem to have health issues. That's part of age.
I mean, I wouldn't have problems if we took special precaution with people with pre-existing health conditions that would make them vulnerable to it. In fact, it actually would be probably more efficient to do that, because you can take your finite amount of resources and concentrate it on the population that would have the most problems with the virus, rather than spreading yourself thin, trying to put a mass quarantine on everyone. That's just my opinion.
Well, as long as you don't incarcerate me in any place that is hostile and claustrophobic, I'll be supportive of it. So, and I gotta be quarantined as a geezer with my dog. You can't take my dog away from me.
Well, are you gonna be any more quarantined than you are now? Is that too claustrophobic for you right now?
No, I'm doing fine, and on a serious note, I do walk a lot with the dog, and I stay away from everybody. I don't allow anybody to touch Pepper, and they all want to come up and touch her because she's just a big, fluffy mink coat walking in the shape of a Siberian husky, because, you know, they all have fur, not real hair. Nobody gets near her to touch her, and, you know, I only go out to go to a bank when I need to, or to go to Safeway, or to another market, or to get gasoline, or to go to the pharmacy, and otherwise, that's it. I'm a homebound guy, and I don't talk to my neighbors. I don't have any interaction with anybody. I see other people walking, and I'll walk in the middle of the street because their streets are empty. I just stay away from everybody. So no, in answer to your question, if this is what senior quarantine would be like, if we were devoting resources to protect the more vulnerable people, it would be frustrating but very tolerable.
Also, I think Elon Musk made the same point as well. That
yeah, he did, with a lot of filth, but absolutely, and a lot of name calling to our governor, which I'm not doing. But but he did make the same point, and a lot of other people have too. And you know, my son who has cystic fibrosis is in the same boat I am, because he's CF is a lung illness, so he's kind of self quarantined in where he lives in Los Angeles, and is pretty well engaged in the same routine I am. So and most of my family in Dallas and Houston, they're all around my age, and everybody has health problems when we get to be around our age. So we're all doing the same thing. And even as societies open up, they're not opening up. Texas is opening up. They're not opening up. They're still staying in and not going out and doing things just because younger folks are and stuff like that. So I think there's a lot of responsible people out there. There probably are irresponsible people too, but even if they opened up California, I'm not going to the beaches, I'm not going to restaurants, I'm not getting my hair cut. I'm being a good little boy.
Well, I can tell you in Alabama right now, they're kind of doing a quasi-opening. You can't really hardly tell, at least I can't, but they say they're going to fully open everything by May 15th. If the trends for the coronavirus infections is going steadily down, so if nothing bad, particularly if there's not some upsurging in the infections, by May 15th we'll be back open, and I'll be so happy because of that.
Well,
look, although I do like teleworking, I love teleworking. In fact, I wish I could do more of it.
Maybe
that's the one good thing about it.
Maybe that'll be one of the changes that happens as a result of this, and a lot of people will do teleworking to kind of prepare us for going to the moon.
I sure hope so. I mean, I would prefer to go to the moon in person, but for a daily commute. For daily commute, I would prefer to avoid all that traffic and just stay home. Besides, fewer cars on the road means the ones that have to go on the road doesn't have to deal with as much traffic. That would also be an upside as well, even if you did have to go to work.
Okay. T, Tim, I got to go. It's getting late, okay?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tim.
Bye-bye.
No problem.
Chaim, you just got breaking news about SLS.
Yeah, I just saw that story.
Yeah, so tell us what's going on with SLS before we sign off.
Okay, well, this is an article in spaceflightnow.com. Hopeful for launch next year, NASA aims to resume SLS operations within weeks. They say here that NASA says work halted by the coronavirus pandemic will resume within weeks. Prepare for the first test firing of the SLS core stage at the Stennis Space Center in Mississippi. So that's pretty good. They've been waiting, it seems, a couple of months to get it back.
So when are they going to do the test firing?
November
2021. I see it.
That's right. November 2021.
So we're more than a year out.
Right.
Boy, they're really late.
Yeah, they're late. And then they say the second flight, SLS Orion flight, late 2022 or early 2023.
Well, here, if you read further down, listeners, it says, according to NASA's current plans, the Artemis 3 mission, you're going to be here forever. You just got another phone call. The Artemis 3 mission, scheduled as soon as 2024, will send astronauts back to the moon on the third SLS Orion flight. Once in lunar orbit, crew members will dock with a lunar lander and attempt a landing near the moon's south pole. So apparently the Gateway, we were not clear on that earlier in the show, the Gateway is not part of the 2024 mission. So what are they going to do? They're going to go down in a lander and then come back up and pick up Orion again and come home?
Yeah, just like Apollo, it sounds.
So we're doing an Apollo mission, which John Hunt, who called a little while ago, was concerned that would sort of take over the profile of our return to the moon efforts, and he was worried about that.
Right. And then there, further down the article, they talk about the core stage being built by Boeing. We know Boeing has had a lot of problems. Hopefully the space division is insulated from all those problems that they had with the airplane division.
Yeah. So, listeners, I will post the URL for this article in the summary of the show. But if anyone wants to find it before I do that, the URL is too long to give out right now. The headline, which you could search for, is Hopeful for Launch Next Year, NASA Aims to Resume SLS Operations Within Weeks. Let's see who your caller is, Chaim. Hi,
okay.
Caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
Hi, this is Ray from Dr. Benaroya's Senior Design Group over at Rutgers. Want to call in to represent the group. We're all listening on the other end, very interested, and wanted to give you a shout out and say thank you for all your work this year, and it's really been a pleasure to work with you, and you know, we've learned a lot from you.
Ray, do you want to go to the moon?
I would love to. That's what he's really been inspiring us to do all along.
So I mean, physically go to the moon, not like go to the moon as the country. You want to physically make the trip to the moon.
Hey, if the opportunity were given to me, I don't think I could pass it up.
How about Mars? Do you feel the same way about going to Mars?
That's a little bit more of a commitment. That might be I'll send someone else there, but I'd be happy to work on the mission.
Are you working on a simulated moon mission? What are you actually doing as a class or aerospace project?
So what we did was more so a proof of concept for what the mechanism would be for basically a hybrid lunar structure that would be sent there on some kind of launch vehicle and then land on the surface and deploy itself and inflate actually into a habitable space. And our project was really just to come up with that concept that would then eventually be built upon and worked into something that would work on the lunar surface.
And you're doing this by computer class, right? You're not holding real classes, are you?
Well, now, yes, we're doing that all virtually, but since it was a full-year project, we did get to actually do all the design work last semester, and we got all of our supplies and parts shipped to us at Rutgers before the classes were canceled, and we got to start putting together part of our prototype, luckily, before we were all sent home. So we got some results out of it, and we were pretty happy with what we came up with.
How many are in your class?
Well, in our graduating class for aerospace engineering at Rutgers, it's about, I would want to say, 60 of us. And then within our senior design group that I'm talking about right now, it's just 5 of us.
So I have another question. It's not really space related, but I'm assuming you're in your early 20s, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I'm 22.
So are you guys and are your associates guys and gals? Are you concerned about the virus? Are you afraid of it? Do you just dismiss the threat? Are you respectful of it? How do you see it? It's I'm assuming it's pretty different than me at 73. How about that? I did a little rhyme there. How do you and your classmates see this virus situation? I'm really kind of curious.
I think from a personal standpoint, none of us are really concerned about our own health, but like many people have said, I'm concerned about my parents, my grandparents, and for that reason, I mean, I'm following all the rules that they put up. I'm staying inside, doing all that kind of stuff. I know a lot of people my age are taking it pretty seriously, some people not so much, but I think for the most part, we try to go along with the guidelines they put out for us.
But you're not that concerned or worried about yourself?
Right. I think if I were to get it, I would probably be okay. So from that standpoint, I'm not too concerned. But, yeah, mostly just for my loved ones and the people who are older.
Okay. And your classmates are around the same, thinking the same way?
I would say so.
Okay. Chaim, do you have anything you want to add to your students' discussion?
Only to say that they were a great group, and they did a lot of innovative thinking. And quite frankly, the whole design was really very, very clever, and there was a lot of 3D printing and advanced manufacturing, and we plan to pick up where we left off this year with another group next year and take it to the next level. So this will be a two-year project, and we hope to have a fully working prototype by the end of next academic year.
Ray, how long have you been in the program and in Dr. Benroya's classes?
I'm a senior now. It will be my fourth year at Rutgers that's finishing up right now. And then I've been working with Dr. Benroya for just this year, and I took a class of his last semester also.
Okay, so you weren't in the classes when I did a guest lecture with his class about 3 years ago, I guess is when it was.
No.
Okay. I just wondered if we had possibly met or if you were in that class when I did a guest lecture appearance.
No, we did get some very interesting guest lectures last semester, too, though. That was a great class, and we got a lot of good exposure there.
Okay. Anything else you want to add, Ray, or anything that you think we should know about your class? Or what do you do next? Are you going to graduate school, or what happens when you graduate?
So I'm going to be doing an internship this summer out with Lockheed Martin Space out in Colorado, and then next year I'll be coming back to work on some master's classes.
And the virus hasn't impacted doing your internship then, correct?
No, luckily not. I was actually pretty surprised when I got the call about a week and a half ago. They told me I'd still be coming out there, so I'm pretty excited to make the trip and actually get to do the internship.
Good for you. I hope we can stay in touch as you go through your career and get your master's degree. And we really appreciate your being able to call in before we ended the program. It's just a real treat to talk to you.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ray. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks to God a lot, Ray. Take care and stay safe for you and your family.
Thank you. You guys, too.
Bye-bye.
Have a great night.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Listeners, the line is available. If you hurry up and want to try to reach our guest, it's 866-687-7223. Chaim, what have we forgotten, omitted, should have talked about, didn't talk about? What else did you want to add for tonight?
I think that's it for the space. Maybe we'll leave the EMP for a future show. I think that.
Yeah.
No point to
well,
get into that at this point.
Well, we're coming up on 2 hours, so we'd end up going 2.5 hours for that.
It's already almost midnight here.
Yeah, so we can do EMP. Although listeners, Bachelor is supposed to be archiving our 10-minute EMP discussion from last week tonight. So if he does that, he's a week behind, but if he does that, it'll be on the Space Show archive website from last Wednesday, which I think was it the 5th? It was still in April, right?
It's still April, yeah.
Yeah, like
the
April
last Wednesday in April.
April 29th, I think, something like that. So that's a 10-minute, not as detailed EMP discussion as we would have had and were planning tonight, but it'll give you an idea of the concerns. And one of the things Chaim proposed, and I've not heard about it coming out of our illustrious government, but that would be if we really do an infrastructure bill as part of the coronavirus bailout sequence. Chaim was talking about the necessity of including EMP protection as part of that necessary infrastructure bill, and that when you look at what it costs to harden the grid or to harden this or that, it's really not as costly as one might think. And we talked a little bit about that in the Bachelor show, but again, we'll have to save that for another program with Dr. Benaroya later on. But if Bachelor gets it up tonight, it'll be on the Space Show website early tomorrow morning, and it'll be on the Bachelor site tonight because I take them off of his site.
Oh, that's good.
Anything else, Chaim?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground tonight. It's been fun.
Do look at the NSS website and get a feel for the ISDC dates for Los Angeles next year.
Okay.
And if you can do it, and if I can do it, that would be a really, really fun time. And
yeah.
I'd love to get back together with you and Shelley again.
Yeah. That's great. Look forward to it.
And just hopefully everybody's healthy, and maybe there'll be a vaccine, or maybe it'll be leaving California alone. Who knows? But
yeah, let's hope.
Hopefully, and maybe airplanes will be flying again in a usual way. Thank you very much for being with us, and for all of you who called and sent in emails, we thank you as well for that. And so good night from Dr. Benaroya, David, and the Space Show, and everybody to remember to wear your mask and wash your hands and protect us geezers, and we really appreciate that on your behalf. And keep looking up. And that's where the action is. Keep looking up. So,
thanks, David.
And thank you, Chaim. I really appreciate it, for staying up late. And once again, everybody, good night from Chaim, myself, the Space Show. Stay safe. Have a great rest of the week.